started with a collaboration with Alejandro Perez and Hanno Salman, who is now in Marseille, and Hanno is in Utrecht, the last thing I heard. And now we have some people that have been incorporated, Susana Landau at the University of Buenos Aires, her student at the University of La Plata, Claudia Scocola, and my student at Adolfo de Unanue, who have been helping us understand the implications of this work. Well, let me start with the plan of the talk. The plan of the talk is why aren't we happy with the standard lore about the origin of structure in the universe. In the past talk, in the last talk, we heard how successful.
Is it supposed to be a special man?
I let you guess. I let you. Okay. So it was supposed to be the shortcomings. Okay. So in the last talk we heard about this about the standard lore and some proposed modifications. I'm going to have a very different point of view, and my point of view is the following. I decided that, well, of course, this is the only situation, the cosmological setting, in which we know that there is something gravitational interacting with something quantum, and on which we have a handle. We have observational data that we can study. And my second point is that when one looks for manifestations of something one doesn't really know exactly what form it should have, I think the best place to look for is to look for places there is that where it's clear there is something we don't understand. And I'm going to try to convince you that we really don't understand the origin of the structure of the cosmic structure in any tight way. I'm going to further suggest that there is an extra element that we have to introduce if we really seek an understanding. And my inference here is going to be that this extra element is tied to quantum gravity. Why tied to quantum gravity? Because, well, quantum gravity is the only arena where we know that we don't have a fully successful theory. So that's the natural place to put things you don't understand. And then I'm going to further show you that although my talk will look at the beginning like pure philosophy, it's not just that, and it can be converted into phenomenological predictions that can make that are testable and that are make the theory or the approach falsifiable, as I think all serious models of physical theories should be. Well, we all know that the last decade is considered a big success for inflationary cosmology. The universe seems to be spatially flat, according to the several last data. That means the omega is very close to one. We also know it solves the horizon problem, the monopole problem, and other things like that. But more important and perhaps more spectacularly, it seems to account for the primordial inhomogeneities in our universe arising from quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field. And the observational data, we all know, are in very good agreement with these predictions, which I find amazing, like this. So let me be the second one to show this picture here. We have this picture of the sky, and you know we basically take this data and make convolutions with harmonic spherics. They describe this in terms of spherical harmonics, and it gives this very nice set of data points, which, as you see, fit very well. I don't know if you can see it here. Fit very nice with a theoretical curve, which is the green line that we see here. Of course, one thing to keep in mind, inflation alone is not responsible for these oscillations. These oscillations have to do with late time physics, plasma oscillations, and inflation itself would only produce the seeds of this fluctuation spectrum, which without this late time physics would be just a flat line. So this is the scale invariant spectrum that the inflation is supposed to predict. Okay, so I said inflation is supposed to predict, and my argument and my position is that it doesn't. There is something very odd in our understanding of the problem, because we are supposed to start with a homogeneous anisotropic spacetime, in which there is a scalar field whose quantum part is also in a state, the vacuum state, that is equally homogeneous and isotropic, and we end up with something that is not homogeneous and isotropic, while the dynamics preserve those symmetries. So where exactly does this lack of homogeneity and anisotropy come from? Well, the standard, or many people think this is just standard mechanics, standard quantum mechanics, the usual problem of quantum mechanics. And my point is that this is not exactly the case, because in the universe, with the universe, we have the only real example of a quantum mechanical closed system by definition. Orthodox interpretation of quantum mechanics, the way we use quantum mechanics and we know it's very successful, requires an external classical measuring apparatus. That's part of the conventional instructions that we learn of how to employ this theory. Actually, this point has been noticed by many other people. Among them, for example, James Hartle argues that one needs some generalized form of quantum theory applicable to cosmology to deal with this problem. Nevertheless, if you ask most experts on the field, they will tell you there is no problem. Nevertheless, if you talk with enough of them, you will see that they will give you very different specific answers, which suggests that even among them there is some discomfort with the views of the others. The most popular answer to this problem is called decoherence. Decoherence is basically, well, it's a well-known aspect of quantum mechanics, but let's see how it works when applied to our convention, to our situation at hand, the cosmological situation. Basically, you start describing your system by tracing over the degrees of freedom of some part that you have identified as an environment, and then you end up describing your system by a reduced density matrix upon doing some other manipulations, usually a time average, the high frequency oscillation of these off diagonal terms make them disappear, and you end up with a diagonal matrix. Of course, the diagonal matrix is only diagonal in this specific basis. The diagonalization would disappear if you change bases. So which bases are you supposed to work with? Well, the answer is that the environment system interaction selects for you the pointer bases in which this matrix is diagonal. But in our case, what is the environment? Well, the point is that inflation has removed all matter and all fields are supposed to be in the vacuum. If you wait enough, inflation has removed all features. That is what inflation does. That is what it was designed to do, if you want. So the answer would be, well, nevertheless, there are some degrees of freedom that are unobservable. That is, we cannot observe them, and we are supposed to trace over them. Well, that would mean that in order to understand how we arrive to the situation in which we exist, which of course requires our universe to have non-homogeneous and non-isotropic features, our inabilities to observe play a crucial role. Okay, this is a picture, I took this picture from Surek, who likes to point out that it's very interesting that, you know, the universe evolves and eventually produces beings that are able to observe and study its origins. And here the point is that it is necessary that these beings have limitations in their observational capacities for us to really understand how they emerge. This, of course, is a closed loop of explanations with very little explanatory value. But even if we overcome this, the coherence faces another problem. As I said, the coherence takes you from this reduced density matrix to a diagonal density matrix, but then you are supposed to interpret that as representing some sort of ensemble of which you are supposed to be living in one specific one, right? The point is that if we do the standard analysis and we look at this density matrix represents still an homogeneous and isotropic situation. You only end up with a non-homogeneous and non-isotropic situation when you choose and decide to state that we live or we are represented by one of these things. So quantum mechanics really tells us that the interpretation should be that all these situations coexist, while it's only the interpretation, the excess of interpretation of saying we are in one of them that makes the inhomogeneity and anisotropy appear in the standard picture. Furthermore, it is well known in the decoherence community, of which I am not an expert, or not a member, that decoherence does not really solve the measurement problem. Let me make some quotes here for you. Many physicists nowadays think that decoherence provides a fully satisfactory answer to the measurement problem. This is an illusion. Here is another one that is more specific. The formal identification of the reduced density matrix with a mixed state density matrix is easily misinterpreted as implying that the state of the system can be viewed as a mixed state as well. The total composite system is still described by a superposition, and it follows from the rules of quantum mechanics that no individual definite state can be attributed to one of the parts of the system. Okay, we know EPR type of experiments prevent us from taking this type of interpretation. Well, there are many others, but let me just go to the last one to show you how, in our situation, we are in even deeper problems. As long as we remain within the realm of mere predictions concerning what we shall observe, that is, what will appear to us, and refrain from stating anything concerning how things are as they were before we observed them, concerning things as they were must have been before we observed them, then no break in the linearity of quantum mechanics is necessary. Okay, this may be true, but precisely in the cosmological setting is a situation in which we need to talk about precisely the state of things as they were before we observed them, because we need to understand how the conditions arose that makes ourselves possible. So what we would like to do in a cosmological setting? Well, cosmology, as I understand it, seeks an historical, that means a time development description of the cosmic evolution that follows the laws of physics. Time development means I should be able to ascribe to each instance of time a physical description of the system, and that should, if our setting is a quantum mechanical setting, then we should be able to assign a quantum mechanical state to the full system at each particular time. Such description should, in cosmology, explain how we arise. That is, it should explain the emergence of primordial fluctuations from which galaxies and stars and planets evolve and which set up the conditions where living organisms such as us can appear. And therefore, it cannot rely on the inabilities, our own inabilities to measure certain things, to explain the emergence of the conditions that make them possible. That is, we cannot justify identifying some degrees of freedom as irrelevant environment simply because we cannot observe them. Yes?
Could we explain what is different in cosmology to any other separation of quantum to classical physics? I mean, whenever you talk about classical physics,
yes,
you talk about the inability to
Yes. The first difference is that in the other cases, you have a very well defined situation. You have indicated what apparatus you are going to use. You have indicated that you are going to describe your apparatus as classical, and then your interaction with the quantum world is you supplying the Copenhagen interpretations. You can, we are all fully aware that you can put the line wherever you want, but that is only a consistency requirement. Nevertheless, you have to put the line anywhere at some point to say, well, now a measurement occurred and my situation after the measurement leads me to this state.
If you measure something in cosmology, then you would be saying
the following. The problem is that in cosmology you want to explain the origin of this instrument itself. How this instrument arose. What were the conditions that allow you to appear and to design and create and send this satellite to the space?
But I had to test that using another instrument.
Right.
So it's the same thing. The only thing I can test is observation.
Right. But look at the following. If you stick to the line, you would say. Normally, I would say, well, I make my apparatus interact with the system I'm measuring, and that produces a collapse of the wave function, however you want to tell it. It leads my state to take the spin of my particle to take one particular direction after I do that. But in the other setting, you would say, well, when I'm observing this cosmological background, my observation and its detection by the W map is what makes the universe become inhomogeneous and anisotropic.
Nobody says that.
Okay, so what does it say? Yes.
If I were to try and answer the question being asked with a positive spin, it seems to me that it's item three that is different in cosmology. The other two, well, in historical development, I suppose, is cosmology, but it's just, I might imagine a theory in which that would rely on measurement ability or inability at current times to explain a quantum classical split. But I understood this to mean in cosmology that would be cheating. Maybe you don't agree with it, but I'm just saying what I understand that last statement to mean, why cosmology is singled out. Because I might imagine building a theory someday that has nothing to do with cosmology, but current physics, in which one could justify identifying degrees of freedoms of relevant environment. But you're saying that in cosmology you shouldn't be allowed to do that.
If I'm going to explain how I arrive.
Now, you might say, even so, why cosmology, but that's what I
understand. I think whenever you make a split between a classical system and a quantum system, you have to decide which degrees of freedom of the fully quantum system you do not, you have to neglect. So this is
right.
True even
okay.
For your standard apparatus. Now, once we agree that any of apparatus that you use to make a measurement fundamentally is a quantum system, you have to decide which degrees of freedom of that apparatus you simply need.
Well, my view is that the whole world is quantum mechanical. Classical is just some, you know, appropriate, sometimes useful description of things. But if I'm not able to tell you under which conditions the state of your system becomes a particular state, you are not able to do quantum mechanics. I have to be able to tell you my state was prepared in this fashion. How do you prepare the state? Well, you measure this. And when you measure, I want to prepare a state of an electron to have the spin up. What do? You measure the spin, you make sure that you selected it to be up, and now you have your spin being up. But that implies that you said, when I measure the spin, the state of the system is now the electron with the spin up. Without that, you are not able to do quantum mechanics. Or I don't know how to do quantum mechanics. Perhaps some other type of quantum mechanics.
Okay. I'm saying it's exactly the same situation. You never measure the whole wave function of the universe. You always measure just part of the wave function.
No, but he's saying something should happen whether you measure or not. That's the distinction. Yeah. Shouldn't matter if you make a measure in cosmology.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Just a quick question. What is time in this segment?
Cosmological time. Well, actually, here is any time. Anyway, I imagine that a theory, satellite theory, will allow me to foliate my space time or my in any way, any, and they should be all compatible. But in practice here, I'm going to use the cosmological time.
Isn't your point that it's some sort of a bootstrap? If you imagine a spherically symmetric quantum system and someone outside, an external observer, measure something about it. They can break the symmetry.
Yes.
They can measure the spin direction or something.
Right.
But if the whole thing evolved to be always spherical symmetry, where does this symmetry gradient come from?
Yeah, that's precisely the point. Can I ask you a favor? I know this is a very... But can we do this discussion afterwards? Because we can stay... I mean, we can do this, but then we'll stay on this topic for the rest of the talk. Okay, other things that you may be asked to accept, which I can, are the following positions. These are positions that I have encountered where I discussed with colleagues. Quantum mechanics does not describe our universe. Our universe was never homogeneous and isotropic. The ensemble was. So here the view is that there exists a large ensemble of universes. Each one of them is in one particular quantum state. And when you superimpose all these states, you get the vacuum, the homogeneous and isotropic thing. The problem is that that's not quantum mechanics. If I have two atoms, one atom here in state A and an atom here in state B, the two atoms are not described by the superposition AB, but by the cross product. So this is cheating. Other positions are our universe is still homogeneous and isotropic. Let me not discuss that one. Other positions, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when the universe stopped being homogeneous and isotropic, but don't even ask when, why, due to what it stopped. Another position is that this is just philosophy, and I should be doing physics. But I'm going to try to convince you that this is not just philosophy.
It's still homogeneous and isotropic.
Even today, homogeneous and isotropic.
The S with the capital.
Yes. Okay. So what would I wish? Well, I would a scheme that allows me, in principle, to assign a quantum state to the system at every time. Use quantum mechanics as a theory about the description of the system. So it's a theory that describes the system and not just our knowledge about it. That allows considerations of issues like the one I'm having. When did the lack of homogeneity and isotropy arise in this particular scale? Where did that originate? When did that originate? And it's going to take the view, all these cannot be satisfied with standard view, that the marriage of general relativity and quantum mechanics, gravity and quantum mechanics, may involve changes in both, not just in GR. So this is a position that I'm adopting from Roger Penrose, which has been advocating these ideas for a long time. So the idea is then to change minimally the standard law of origin of quantum structure by adding the self-induced collapse hypothesis. This is an hypothesis that is inspired on Penrose's idea, and I'm going to explain it very, very detailed some moment. So, as I said, we're going to change both quantum mechanics and gravity in some minimalistic way. The idea is that the fundamental theory that describes gravity is some other type of theory, some more fundamental degrees of freedom, and the metric description is just an effective one. And moreover, quantum mechanics is incomplete, needs to be completed by some additional postulate. Why quantum mechanical collapse? Because it's the only mechanism capable of taking a symmetric state into an asymmetric state while the dynamics preserves the symmetry. The fact that the quantum selection tells me you have this thing is symmetric and now you have to live with this, then you are in an asymmetric situation, even if you started with a symmetric situation. And of course, the new element is brought into physics is assumed to be brought into physics by quantum gravity, is a collapse that needs not rely on an external agent to induce it. So there is no measurement or no measuring device or anything of that sort. Okay, so how do we, this is, very wild speculations, but how do we do that in a minimalistic way? Well, the first thing is we're going to describe gravity at the semi-classical level. That means coupling the Einstein tensor with the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor. This, of course, we know has some problems, but we are going to assume that this holds at least for situations in which we have relatively sharp values for the states here are states in which the energy momentum tensor has relatively sharp values. It need not be eigenstates of the energy momentum tensor, but relatively well-picked states. The quantum state of the system is going to undergo jumps. So in particular, I'm going to be treating only the matter degrees of freedom fully quantum at this effective level. And they are going to undergo these jumps. So state will jump. But when the state jumps, the energy momentum tensor jumps. And these jumps cannot be accompanied by the Einstein tensor, so I have to add some quantity that will, in some sense, absorb or back-react to this quantum jump.
Is Q only a function of the metric or something else?
Is Q some unknown thing that represents effectively how these drastic behaviors of the underlying degrees of freedom of geometry, which are occurring when there is a quantum jump? They are supposed to be off.
It depends on the matter field.
It will depend on it, yes.
So what does QAB mean?
QAB, as I said, is somehow the back reaction of the fundamental degrees of freedom of geometry to the quantum jumps in the matter field. This is simply because it's not, the theory is not consistent.
Is it that part of TAB which is not its expectation value?
Well, no. Here it's supposed to be something about the quantum degrees of freedom of geometry that are not representable in terms of metrics. Okay, so let me say what it means in practice. In practice, it says this thing will absorb whatever jump this does when the quantum state jumps, and otherwise will be zero. So except at the instances where the quantum jump occurs, this thing will disappear, will vanish. So after and before the collapse, this Q vanishes. So in fact, it will not have no. Its only role is to make this equation consistent while this thing jumps. The motivation is the idea that, in general, the quantum gravity degrees of freedom are not excited, except at the times when such jumps happen. Then they have to do something.
Constraints. That is,
the constraints are
like
by.
You have the expectation value of TAB. Is that separately constrained, and then QAB?
No, the constraints are simply obtained by, from this equation, by a contraction with the normal vector from to the hypersurface in which you are considering. I mean, the constraints are encoded in this equation, the new constraints.
Can you say why is it inconsistent?
Because the divergence of this thing is automatically zero. The divergence of the energy momentum tensor is zero, but when the state changes in this dramatic way, the divergence of that object cannot be zero.
That's what I meant. How do we know that?
Well, I don't know that, but I'm sure I can make a jump in which that will not be zero.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe Mac. Yeah, only if it's possible, but I just wondered if you had a more
concrete example.
Yeah. I mean, if you could.
Let me think. I think it should.
Because then it would be clear, but you can't do that.
Let me think. They're just in case, if you want. Sorry.
Perhaps this is related to what I just asked, but how should I view this equation? Given a state and some matter operators, I compute the right-hand side, and I solve for the effective metric and Q?
Well, no. Q will appear only when the state jumps. So if you give me a...
Q is a function of the state as well.
Yes, Q will have. Yes. This is supposed to be an effect. I mean, I imagine fundamentally there are some fundamental degrees of freedom of matter, and those fundamental degrees of freedom are described by some operator, and this operator are connected to the operators describing the matter degrees of freedom and as full operator equation. In my setting, under these conditions, gravity is such that can be described essentially semiplastically. Matter will have some quantum remaining quantum aspects that I'm
qualifying. So you say that the expectation value of TAB is conserved.
No, the TAB is conserved as an operator.
So,
but the expectation value is not conserved. Sorry?
And you say that the expectation value
is not conserved.
It's not conserved.
Why? Because the state jumps in a non unitary way.
So, okay.
That's why.
And essentially, you restore unitarity of the TAB alone by putting the.
And why can't you just absorb the QAB into the TAB?
Well, because it's supposed to represent
geometry. This is just the convention, your convention, but from the point of view of observations.
You will see that what I'm going to do, given this assumption, the Qs only back react to the jumps and do nothing else. So they are not going to intervene in my predictions at this point. Okay.
But Q is not a smooth background, so it cannot absorb the field of verb of the TAB because I presume it's computer.
Is there any observation that I can measure Q directly?
No, we will see observations now. Let me go to the observations. So, what's the goal of this thing? Is to try to extract some characteristics of the new physics from the observation. So we'll try to do phenomenology here. Okay. So how do we operate in that setting in the cosmological situation? Well, we describe the universe as a homogeneous isotropic universe in which I'm going to be interested only in the so-called scalar perturbations, which I'm going to put here and allow it in principle to be non-zero, although initially it will be zero. So if we have our homogeneous and isotropic universe when phi is equal to zero, described by the scale factor, which depends on the conformal time. This quantity is called the Newtonian potential and it represents the only aspect of geometry that is going to be in which we are going to be interested at this point. The scalar field, as usual, is described in terms of a homogeneous, background plus fluctuations, which are going to be subject to quantization. It's convenient to work instead with the rescaled field Y, which is simply the rescaled fluctuating field and its conjugate momentum. And then Einstein's equations, classical Einstein's equations, take this particular form, where this coefficient S depends on the background behavior of the inflaton field. This is the standard, very standard result. Here, mu is a quantity that depends on the derivative, twice the second derivatives of the scale factor, and it's zero in a slow during the slow ruling in the slow ruling approximation. Okay, the point is that we quantize now the rotating part of the inflaton field. In the standard way, we put everything inside the box just to make sure we don't have to deal with the infrared problems. And now the semi-classical version of Einstein's equation takes this form. So this is just Einstein's equations that I wrote before, except I have deleted here the Q term, but this is supposed to be the equations before and after any collapse of the state. This here, the expectation value is in any state whichever the quantum field may be. From here, it's very easy to Fourier decomposition to write the Fourier component of this field. It's simply given in terms of the expectation value of this momentum, the momentum operator for the field, for the inflaton field. Then what happens? Before the collapse, the state, the vacuum state, has zero expectation value for the field and for its momentum. And therefore, the Newtonian potential is zero. Our universe is homogeneous and isotropic in that scale. The assumption is that then at some particular time, called time of collapse of mode K, the mode K collapses according to various schemes. The first scheme we're going to consider is the symmetric scheme in which, the assumption is the following. After the collapse, the state of the field is such that both the momentum and the field operators acquire a expectation value that is given by a random number times the uncertainty of the same quantity in this previous state, which was the vacuum state. Yes, it's
not a result of a measurement.
Not the result of any measurement. Nobody did that. Yes. These X's are random, some random variables, which in our universe they will have one particular value. Okay. There are other schemes, of course. Here we have something that is called the gravity cone coupling preferred scheme. And for here, we remember just that the momentum was acting as a source of the geometric fluctuations, but the field itself was not in the inflationary schemes. And then we say, well, perhaps it's only this object that changes its expectation value upon collapse. So I'm going to assume that exactly the same thing for the momentum conjugate, but I'm going to assume that the new state has still has zero expectation value at the time of collapse for this mode. This is only at the time of the collapse. So this is the value of the is the expectation value of the field and its momentum conjugate at the time of collapse. Another possibility suggested by Almeida-Riaga and analyzed by my student recently is to suppose that the fields collapse along the ellipse or the semi-axis of the that characterize the Wigner functional corresponding to the vacuum. So the vacuum state can be seen as a Swiss state, and for that state I can look at the Wigner functional, look where the Wigner function is maximal, and say that the new field values, the expectation values will be along that diagram. Okay. So these are very different, three different schemes for collapse. As I said, once we have that, I can compute what is the expectation value of this phi field at the time in which I am going to observe this fluctuation. So we look, use now the standard evolution of this object, and compute what is the expectation value. It's what is the expectation value late in late time. And from there, extract what is the Newtonian potential for that wave mode. And from that, we are going to compare with observations. That is the Newtonian potential, and that is, can be connected with observations. But two things are needed to make precise predictions. I need to tell you what collapse scheme I use, and I have to tell you what is the time of collapse of each of the various modes. With these two pieces of information, I can now obtain a precise description of what has happened.
How would you know what collapse is contained? I mean, how would the observer know
what
collapse of the mode?
Okay, so the idea is the following. The idea is now make generic proposals, see what do they predict for the observations, and now take observations and say, well, what can I say about?
Okay, so you're in there.
I'm going in this direction now. I'm going in this direction now. Make predictions, compare with observations, and
because you cannot interfere as an observer, of course. To
yes, no, I cannot interfere. Okay. Of course, the direct comparison needs to take into account late time physics, such as reheating and plus and acoustic oscillations, which we are not doing in general here. So I'm going to try to compare with things as they would have been without the acoustic oscillations. So what are the observational quantity? The observational quantity, of course, is the variation in temperature with respect to the mean as a function of the angle on the sky. And this is identified with the Newtonian potential at the surface of last scattering, because the Newtonian potential is what produces excess redshift. There are other mechanisms, but this is the important one. The Newtonian potential is what is responsible for the redshift or excess or redshift compared with the normal redshift associated with the expansion. So So the Newtonian potential basically is a measurement of the change in frequency, and the change in frequency of the photons is associated with the angular dependence. The change in frequency depends on where the photon was emitted, because the Newtonian potential from which it has to climb up is different as a function of the angle, and that produces the differences in temperature. Okay, so now I have this function. I reconstructed from summing over all the Fourier coefficients, and from there, this quantity computed on the surface of last scattering, that means here is d, I put d for decoupling, so this is the time of decoupling and the position as a function of, I mean, the direction, the position on the surface of the scattering. This quantity convoluted with an harmonic steric is the quantity that the experimentalists measure. It's called alpha Lm. So for these alpha Lms, we have this explicit expression now, where all the quantities are here known except this function f of k, where information about the collapse, the mechanism of the form of, or the scheme of collapse, and the time of collapse is hidden. All the other things are given here. The only quantity here that needs an explanation is this u of k, which is supposed to represent the late time physics, which, of course, I am not interested and I'm not going to discuss. This would be one if I forget about acoustic oscillations, for example. Well, the point here is that the quantity that we observe is a sum over many modes, right? So it's a sum of complex numbers over all possible modes. That is, the quantity that I want to observe is a complex number that is a sum of many complex numbers in essentially a random walk in complex space. For a random walk, of course, I cannot predict the size, but I can predict the most likely value of its magnitude. So this is the quantity that I'm going to be interested in. What's the most likely value of this magnitude that is essentially the a random walk produced by the collapse of all the different k modes that we are to observe. Initially, well, let me not say this. Once we do that, we have an expression for this quantity in which we see several things appearing. First of all, this function u that is, let me say a few things. So the quantity becomes an integral over x. And this x is an adimensional quantity, and the dimensions that appear are only the size of the surface of last scattering, which appear in three places. One, it appears here associated with possible deviations from slow rolling, this quantity mu that I said we were going to set to zero in the slow roll approximation. There is this other parameter that is associated with late-time physics. Of course, there are acoustic oscillations, which we know tells us something about the size of the surface of last scattering, but we are not going to be interested in that. And then there is this function c, which is associated with the square of that function f that we had previously, which encodes, therefore, two things, the collapse scheme and the time of collapse. And this function turns out to be non-trivial. In scheme one, for example, this function c of k, c of its argument, has this form. In the standard case, the standard answer, c would be replaced by 1. In our analysis, c is replaced by this combination in which we have this extra parameter, this parameter, which is a multiplication of the wave number of the mode in question times the time of its collapse. So in general, then, this quantity depends on this number in a non-trivial way. The way to obtain the standard result would be either to assume this delta equals zero, and that is very strange because would basically said that the time of observation has to be equal to the time of collapse, and then the collapse would be occurring for all the modes at the surface of last scattering, which I think is very wild. The most normal thing is that this quantity, c of k, be independent of k. If that quantity is a constant, then all our function does is essentially renormalize the overall value of the whole fluctuation spectrum. So we already learned something. To obtain the standard, the results that we observe, it seems we require something like time of collapse to be necessarily inversely proportional to the wave mode. That's what we learn from this. If we don't do that, we can get predictions. Well, no, I have put time equals zero.
Where?
At the end of inflation.
At the end of
inflation. Okay. It's conformal time.
Yeah.
Okay. If we don't do that, we can get deviations, radical deviations from, if we allow the parameters to be anything, we can get radical deviations from the observations. Here we have, the predicted value in our scheme for the spectrum as seen in this alpha LM parameters versus L, where you see that we have extra oscillations with these features here, which are of course not seen in the data, and therefore this particular scheme here can be ruled out. Okay? This would be if we allow this quantity C of K to be, a function of K. Here, I don't remember exactly what function, but a wild function of K. We get something that is not, that can be ruled out. The point is that we can do phenomenology. Equally,
you ignore all the things of the heating and whatever.
Yes. So yes. Well, no. This has been convoluted. This has been convoluted with the reheating. Because we get the standard peak, this extra peak is the acoustic oscillation. But on top of that peak, we have this extra feature here, which are not seen in the data. Equally, in the large scale, the power structure of the matter distribution, these effects would be seen, like, if you want, lack of structure at certain regimes. Well, it's not clear, of course, at this point, how these things would convolute with the nonlinear behaviors that we know are very important in the matter distribution, but in principle they could be seen. Of course, it's more, things are clear, more clean in the CMB spectrum where everything is linear. The other two schemes give radically different functions. Well, this doesn't seem very different, but it's different. It's a different function, functional depending on CK. And the scheme number three is an even more strange-looking behavior. So we can, in principle, distinguish between these schemes. Here I have just, these functions are very difficult to see. The three schemes give us different functions C of K. Here we have C of K of scheme one, of scheme two, and of scheme three. They are all different. And in principle, that makes them distinguishable. We are now in the process of doing the early phenomenological analysis. So we want to compare different collapse schemes and various possibilities for the collapse time and eventually other parameters. For example, we know that if I take the time of collapse of mode K to depend on K in this way, we recover the standard spectrum. So we are going to assume now small deviations of that form, so that plus a constant here, and try to obtain now bounds on A and B. When we do that, we obtain for the different schemes different things. Here we have a plot of L number, which I think is measured until something close to 1,000, I don't really know exactly. The predicted quantity, which is alpha LM square multiplied by properly normalized, which as I said, would be a flat line in the standard case and without the the acoustic oscillations. I have taken out the acoustic oscillations. I'm not interested in them. And in the standard inflationary scheme, you would get just a flat line. Here we see how things can deviate from a flat line by the different choices of these parameters A and B. So we can have, well, something that is very close to a flat line, something that is a flat line, then you raise and then you go down, things, different types of behaviors depending on the time of collapse, how you make the time of collapse depend on the function on K. This is for the scheme one. Scheme 2 gives different behavior. Scheme 2 tends to give something that starts by lowering, and eventually, for some values of the thing, it can raise up again. So the point is that by investigating the behavior of this function of L, C of L, or alpha Lm, most likely value as a function of L, for very large values of L, we can start looking for these patterns of behavior and start saying something about which collapse scheme may have given rise to these quantities. Collapse scheme number three is relatively similar to scheme number two. I will not go into all the values here, but just to show you the different behaviors. But we can do even more than connect to observations and extract things from observations. We can start even testing some ideas. For example, we can now think in a more concrete specification of the Penrose idea, which says the following, that the collapse of the wave function occurs when two coexisting alternatives, so we'll see quantum mechanics describes things as, I mean, this box can be coexisting in a state where it's here and where it's here. So I imagine a state in which the box is in this superposition of states living here and living here. I'm supposed to compute what is the Newtonian interaction, the gravitational interaction energy between the two alternatives. And if this energy reaches the Planck mass, then the system is supposed to collapse in one way or the other. This is Penrose's proposal for how collapse occurs in the normal situations. We are going then to do that, generalize in a very naive way, that idea to the cosmological setting, and ask ourselves the question whether this scheme satisfies our phenomenological requirement. We already learned how the time of collapse should depend on the wave mode for things to be similar to what we observe. Now the question is, does this produce that or not? Well, we can compute the energy, assuming, basically, as I said before, we have said basically that the collapse of a mode was going to be, take the uncertainty of the quantity before, for example, pi. Pi was in the vacuum state, had this type of wave function. And now I'm going to say it collapses, so it will collapse, let's say, either to here or here. So these are my two alternatives. And I'm going to then see this quantity as really coexisting these two alternatives. And now I compute the energy of interaction of this alternative with this alternative, the Newtonian energy. What is that? Well, that's the potential, the Newtonian potential associated with the phi being in this state. Being in this mode, with the density, the energy, the density, the matter density associated with this other alternative. So I take the two alternatives and compute this energy of interaction, which is the Newtonian potential times the density of the second alternative. And we have perfectly well clear expressions for these quantities. I substitute in all my scheme, and I obtain the energy density for the individual modes as a function of the time of collapse. Of time, not collapse here. So this quantity has this form, where A is the scale, the cosmological scale factor, V prime is the potential Newtonian, the potential of the inflaton field. And after you substitute all of that, A depends on the, of course, on cosmic, on the conformal time. And from there, you can say, well, when will this quantity be equal to Planck mass? From there, you extract the value of eta of collapse for the mode K. So the time of collapse will be the time where this quantity is equal to the Planck mass. You extract the quantity, and it takes this form with Z having this specific form. Sorry, I ran out of time. 4 minutes, I ran out of time. I'm going to take 2 more minutes of abuse. I will abuse you. So the point is that this quantity is independent of k. In this scheme, k times the time of collapse is independent of k. So surprisingly, this quantity, this scheme works. In this scheme, one can even compute exactly at which time did the mode collapse as a function, let's say, of the mode number, or as a function of the time of the horizon crossing of the mode, et cetera, et cetera. So let me not get into all the details. One can compute and ask all these, answer all these interesting questions. So conclusions. My conclusions are that there is something missing, and it's related to quantum mechanics, in our understanding of the origin of the cosmic structure. And something like a self-induced collapse seems to be required to take us from an homogeneous and isotropic state to something that doesn't have that symmetry. The present proposal has the required features. Of course, it's not far from unique, or we don't have any claim to that sort. It leads to phenomenological predictions that can be constructed with observations. These are things I haven't talked about. It offers a path to alleviate the fine-tuning. The scheme, in this scheme, one of the strongest predictions is that there would be no tensor modes. No tensor modes are excited in this scheme because gravity is not quantized. Only the scalar field is quantized. Gravity is not quantized. And then tensor modes arise only at higher order, so they will be highly suppressed, which, of course, makes the theory falsifiable. And, of course, my point is that new physics seems to be there. We are observing that. And we just need to start exploring it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this very clear talk, which doesn't leave any open questions. Do you have any questions?
It's very, very short.
Yeah. So that they allow for a very short answer.
Yeah. Why there are no tensor modes? Couldn't the Q during the jump produce some sort of back reaction?
Basically, the reason that there are no tensor modes is the following. You have a scalar field. Its derivative in the background contains only time derivatives. And the energy momentum tensor contains things that have this form. Okay? This leads to scalar perturbations. The things that would lead to tensor perturbations would be things like derivative I of this guy times derivative J of delta phi.
So your homogeneity.
The homogeneity of the background prevents this term from arising. The term that would arise is this, which is now higher order. So that's why they're not
there. But you could have, in principle, if you violated homogeneity.
Oh, if the background violated by homogeneity. Yes, but, yeah.
Do you insist on the question?
No. If you ask this, but, well, may I? So the production of inflationary perturbations is formally almost identical to the Schwinger process.
Yes.
QED.
Yes.
So would your arguments also apply to the Schwinger process?
So. Yes.
The
Schwinger process, you have vacuum, an electric field, and you're supposed to predict appearances of electrons and positrons. The evolution of the state, the unitary evolution of the state that takes you from the vacuum to the future, preserves homogeneity. Let's say things are independent of X and Y if the electric field is in the direction of Z. This is independent. The state will be independent of X and Y, and the unitary evolution of the state will remain independent of X and Y. So if you want to say that an electron positron was created in this particular location, you have to use the projection postulate quantum mechanics. Otherwise, you cannot end up with a state that is not a translational invariance in the direction perpendicular to the electric field in the Schwinger process.
So the last thing, I will once again.